Hi, this is Helen, and thank you for joining me for a cup of teal. Teal is shorthand for the future of work. It means bringing your whole self to work, a focus on purpose and self-management. And this podcast is a chat over a cup of tea with the people who are making this happen in health, care, and public services. Stories of self-management in action. Andy Brogan is our National Advisor for Improvement, and he's developed confirmation practices. They've made such a significant difference to the way I personally work, and in fact, they're on my desk as I speak. We use them both in the national team and the local teams every 2 weeks. And in this podcast, he explains the problem that confirmation practices were designed to solve, what they are, and how to use them. Andy, can we start with what is the problem that confirmation practices help us to solve? Why do they exist?
I think there's two primary problems they're trying to solve that were my motivation for creating them. So the first one is that inevitably we live in a pretty complex world. There's loads going on. We're constantly being bombarded with urgent priorities and important priorities and everything else besides. So I wanted to find a way to help people to kind of see through the fog so that it becomes easier to focus on what really matters. So the idea was, you know, if we can't manage everything, we might as well manage what matters. So how do we do that? So that was the first motivation, and kind of baked into that was this idea that traditionally the way that's been done is through things like setting targets. But we know that targets aren't terribly useful. In fact, they're harmful in complex environments because they encourage us to reduce complexity to something that isn't a true representation of the thing we're managing. So in seeing through the fog, I wanted to deal with what I think is the second major problem we're trying to solve, which is how do we move away from this pathological relationship that organizations have had with numbers, with performance management. And I think there's a whole nest of issues that are bound up in that. Targets is one example, but I think there's a broader issue around how accountability damages a felt internal locus of control. In other words, it damages people's agency. It kind of creates a compliance focus, which detracts from people being able to feel like they are able to take responsibility, show initiative, and so on.
And I'm conscious that lots of people listening to this might be the very first time they've heard of confirmation practices. So could you explain what they are? So I know that there are different types of confirmation practices. How do you describe them?
Yes. Yeah, so fundamentally, they're routines for reflective practice that help us make sense of what's happening around us, that help us to really anchor back to what matters and help us to think about what do we need to do or do differently in order to do better into the future. The way they work is pretty straightforward, in fact. It's about, instead of using measures as our primary means of understanding performance, it's using statements about what good looks like. So basically just framing sentences that describe things that we believe are really, really important and that capture the essence of what would be true if things were going well. And we use them to reflect and to decide action and then to stay on top of action.
And we've been using them in wellbeing teams for several years now. In fact, I clearly remember, Andy, the session you came to do to introduce us to confirmation practices. And I really rudely said, why are you calling them confirmation practices when they're reflective practices? You can't see me now, but I'm blushing at the memory of that. But we found them really powerful in the national team and directly with wellbeing workers. And CQC, the regulator, were really interested in the fact that we had used them to replace supervision as a way of reflecting on how well we're doing in what really matters and supporting each other to progress. So if we were looking at a confirmation practice in front of us now, there are certain headings and columns, Andy. Talk us through those.
The idea here is, in terms of general reflective practice or my experience of it, what I saw was often it took a long time, often people didn't make time for it because they assumed it would take a long time. So the The slight difference here is to create a structure for reflective practice that allows it to be fast but also effective. So the column headings you talk about lean into that. So the first one is we've got our statements around what good looks like. And as you'll appreciate, Helen, you know, there's a process of iteration in coming up with those statements where typically we'll start off with far too many. And through using them, we quite quickly work out which ones do most work for us. So the goal is to end up with a half dozen or so statements that describe what good looks like. In order to reflect on those, the first step is to assign a score to each statement. The way I tend to do this is I invite people to give them a score from 1 to 5. So anything that's down at the sort of 1 or 2 end means the statement is completely false. Anything that's 4 or 5 means the statement is mostly or completely true. And the point around deciding the score is actually deliberately to escape the problems that most kind of performance data tends to introduce, where the job becomes making the score look good. So this is a little counterintuitive at times when I first explain it. But in essence, what we do when we do confirmation practices is we really emphasize that the purpose of the score is to help us get what's in our gut into the open. So I encourage people not to think about the score they're giving. This isn't trying to accurately rate how true something is. This is just about emoting how we feel about that aspect of our work. And that's trying to, again, create the psychological safety for people to just surface the things that are in their heart or in their gut without having to worry about whether they're right. So that's the second column, is the score. Then the third column is essentially just a quick capture of our reasons why we may have given that score. So if we scored it low, what is it that is making us feel uncertain or anxious? If we've scored it high, what is it that's giving us confidence? And then lastly, once we've talked about that or reflected on that ourselves, we have a column that's around what action we're now going to take, which might be to do nothing if we've scored high, or it might be to do stuff to improve or to consolidate the success we're already seeing. But it's about specifically being concrete on what are the things we're now going to do as a result of having reflected.
And what's the role of coaching in supporting people to use these and use them confidently and competently?
A couple of roles, I think. So the first thing is confirmation practices can be done as a private personal reflection in which there is no coach. So that's a legitimate use of them. But my experience is while that's useful to do, it's not typically enough to do. So one of the things coaches can do is to help an individual to reflect more accurately. So I know when I first talked to many clients around using confirmation practices, one of their concerns is how can we ensure that people aren't just telling themselves a comfortable story rather than really examining what's going on? And I think coaches have a key role to play there. So as you know, I kind of talk about a coaching framework you can use with confirmation practices that is about keeping the locus of control, the agency, with the individual that's reflecting, but that helps them to practice their empathy and their mutuality in order to reflect more accurately. The second role of the coach is to then help those individuals to locate where their energy to act is. So having reflected, having seen that there are opportunities to do things differently or better, helping people to really kind of pinpoint what is it that they're actually going to commit to doing. So rather than having a nice list of things we could do, what are we actually going to do? What do we really genuinely have energy for? So coaches can help people key into that. Thirdly, coaches can help people to then be really concrete about those actions. So one of the things I've found helps is to move away from this idea of having kind of vague, long-term statements about what we could do to improve, and to turn that into actually what are we going to do before the week's out, or, you know, by the end of today, what can we have done? So really converting the energy to act into something that is deeply practical and moves us forward. Confirmation practices are often most useful, I think, when they're done in a team environment. that's a great opportunity for people to use their gut to give the scores that are true to them, but against the same statements about what they all think matters, and therefore to surface differences in perspective. And in that context, one of the things the coach is doing is helping people to really listen to each other's perspective. And that can be great for team building, can be great for getting a much greater sense of shared purpose and shared priorities. So that's another useful role for coaches. And I guess the last role that I commonly see for coaches is also to do what I call the second order confirmation practices. So this is essentially reflecting back to people that are using confirmation practices on how well they're using them. And that's a kind of reinforcing loop. So one of the sort of most productive ways to get reflective practice into regular use, so that it doesn't become a luxury, it becomes an inherent part of how we're working and how we're making sense of our work, is to actually reflect on how effective our reflective practice is. that sounds like a sort of rabbit hole one could disappear down, but actually in practice, by giving coaches that role, or by giving people that have traditionally perhaps had positions of formal authority that role, it can be a really useful reinforcing loop that helps people to understand that this stuff matters and that the organization values it, and therefore it helps it to kind of have rocket fuel.
And when we're talking about coaches, it's something that lots of people in different situations can do. So in wellbeing teams, in the national team, we take it in turns to be partnered with each other. We complete our confirmation practices individually and then share them in our pairs. And we coach each other to explore why we gave each other, why we gave ourselves the number that we gave ourselves, and as you said, what we're going to do about it. And then we post our what we intend to do over the next 2 weeks in a Slack group so that everybody can see that. So it's something that peer supporters and buddies and other people can do. Is that right, Andy?
Absolutely, that's exactly right. And I really like the idea of it being done non-hierarchically. So this idea of peer support or doing it in teams or, these sorts of things, I think that massively helps with the ambitions around psychological safety and agency and personal responsibility and all of those things. Another thing you touched on there, Helen, was about making this stuff visible. Mm-hmm. So again, I think that's super helpful. And because the scores in confirmation practices are deliberately subjective, they're kind of explicitly subjective, so nobody should be worrying about whether the score is right, because it's not truth apt. It's always true that the score is right, in so much as it's just a reflection of your subjective experience. So because that's the case, it's much easier to share that publicly without fear of reprimand. And what I found is doing that drives really helpful conversations. So people seeing that they see the world differently and just having a chance to talk about that is super helpful.
I completely agree. One of the things that Michelle did in her time as wellbeing leader with the wellbeing teams in Wigan was that people would pair up to do their confirmation practices around their role as part of team meetings every 2 weeks. And they'd do them with their buddy, but then they posted them visibly on a big poster. So whilst you were having a conversation just with your buddy, you then got to see everybody's score. And Michelle would ask, what are you noticing here? And that would start different conversations. So yes, I think the transparency around it for us has been really significant.
Yeah. I mean, one of my favourite types of confirmation practice, you touched on there being different types. So one of my favourite ones is what I call checkout practices. So just at the end of meetings, or it could be at the end of a conversation, the people that have been involved will very quickly score how well the meeting met its purpose or how well the conversation went. So sometimes that involves using specific statements like, I'm clear what needs to happen next, might be an example. Sometimes it's just this meeting was worth my time. But what I found is really cool about those is, doing a round robin where the chairperson just captures people's subjective scores on a flip chart to make it public almost always drives a completely different end to the meeting. So mm-hmm. in some situations, what I've seen is that's a celebration of, we did really well, brilliant, let's just, you know, pat ourselves on the back. But very often it's that people are leaving the meeting with completely different experiences of what's happened, completely different understandings of what's meant to happen next. And no one had felt able to voice that. So just this super simple routine of quickly scoring how things have gone before you leave the meeting shows that difference, and immediately prompts people to talk about, okay, well, before we leave the room, can we just square away what it is that means you scored at a one and I've scored at a five?
So that's a fantastic way to be more honest with each other, have more courageous conversations, make sure we have the same understanding of what's going on, or we're airing where there's differences. What are you noticing with the organisations who are starting to use, particularly the meeting practice you've just described, Andy?
You know, I think Saski Dorman and yes. Adrienne Rogers down in Dorset, so they've used this, and they were one of my first clients to experiment with it. And so one of the things that they've found is that in their multidisciplinary team meetings, so they work in healthcare, it's actually really shifted people's readiness to sort of be brave. In actual fact, you might even say that it's moved it from a feeling of needing to be brave to actually just feeling like, well, of course we'd share this stuff because no one's judging. This is about sense making. They've articulated that their MDTs are much more productive, much more collegiate, and focus on different things. So people are developing a more coherent sense, a shared sense of, you know, what does good look like? And also it's sort of rehabilitating the world of performance management, where it's not about keeping score on each other and holding each other to account, but it's much more about what can we learn from this and how can we develop shared priorities and a shared understanding of what needs to happen. I think it's starting to, for them, create the environment of psychological safety that we so often talk about.
What's the role of data in confirmation practices?
Yeah, so it's an interesting one, this. So I, as I said at the top, I deliberately developed these to escape the pathological relationship organisations have with data, or traditional organisations have had. But it is actually super important that as part of using confirmation practices, you still recognise data has a role. So I think how I'd articulate it is starting with statements about what good looks like rather than numbers is really important, because in the way I've just described with Saski and Adrienne, it starts to rehabilitate your relationship with performance management. So it starts to help people realize that this is a learning process rather than a scorekeeping process. So I think that's the first important thing to say before getting into the data. And then as that starts to happen, one of the key ways to use data then is to aid the process of reflection. So as we discuss our scores about, you know, how we feel things are going, we might appeal to data to help us then more accurately reflect. So one of the key things a coach might do, for example, is invite people to talk about their subjective experience of performance, and then talk about what data would be helpful to them to understand what's really going on and to inform their gut feel. So again, this is about keeping agency and the locus of control with people, but the coach guiding a conversation through what data would help us to make sense of this is really important, really useful. But I think I would say the role of data is definitely not scorekeeping, it's sense making. So I tend to stay away from the idea that we're going to have permanent measures of success, because I think that encourages us into scorekeeping, and I tend to encourage us towards instead using data in a way that is much more tactical, much more about exploring and discovering our next opportunity to improve rather than keeping score on the system.
Absolutely. The last time I did confirmation practices recently was with Emily, who was my buddy. We rotate buddies every week. to get a different perspective on what we're doing. And one of my statements is around my confidence in how much and how well I'm sharing what we're doing and learning in wellbeing teams. And some of the data that we look at is how many podcasts I've done, how many blogs I've done, how many tweets I've done, because that all relates to how confident I'm feeling in my progress. But what we don't look at is how many people are listening to my podcasts, how many people are following my blogs, because that's not something I'm directly in control of. So anything else that's useful to say about data, Andy? Because I know that one person said to me, how great that I can look at people's scores to know how well they're doing. But confirmation practices is nothing about that, is it?
No, exactly. That's an understandable sort of misuse, but nonetheless a misuse. And I think it's one of the reasons why, as you know, Helen, I kind of probably bore people to tears with the best way to get the value out of confirmation practices is to really deeply understand the problem they're solving first. So the danger is to rush into their use rather than, first of all, being super, super clear around, so what problem do we have around how we currently manage performance? So that's one thought. A second thought, though, just on data, is what I've found, which wasn't part of the version one of confirmation practices, is that it can be useful to have what we might call below the waterline data. Mm-hmm. So this comes from David Marquette's book, Turn the Ship Around. But he was, as you know, a submarine captain, and he talked about, you know, there are decisions that are above the waterline. In other words, a bad decision doesn't sink the ship. Mm-hmm. And there are those below the waterline where, you know, we're in all sorts of trouble if we've got holes in us there. So I think a limited amount of below the waterline data, in other words, kind of red flags of, if this is true, then we know we've got a problem, can be useful, but its use is to help us to know where to go and start sense making. So it's, again, it's not keeping score in the system. It's just helping us to know where we need to direct our attention first. In that regard, I can understand why the person that, you know, you've talked about in that example might want to use scores as a way of going and kind of placing attention. The big caveat, of course, is if you're going to do that to the scores within confirmation practices, you will start to affect how people give the scores. So I think it's critically important you don't do that. But you can use other forms of data, for instance, complaints data, mm-hmm. as a way of saying, well, you know, we're seeing complaints arising. Maybe we need to go and focus on that and understand it.
So you'd never use the scores in confirmation practices as a reflection on somebody's performance. The purpose of them is simply for me to reflect on how I think I'm doing, to then have a conversation about where I see opportunities to improve.
Correct. Yeah, I'd never ever use the scores someone subjectively gives as a way of keeping score on them. That's essentially, it's fundamentally opposite to the whole philosophy of the approach.
Exactly. So paint a big picture for us here, Andy. If you were invited to go and work with a startup to explore processes that could be helpful and confirmation practices as part of those, where do you start? For example, do you start with purpose or values? Where would you begin if you could start anywhere?
So if it's a startup scenario, purpose is a great place to start. So for me, that means being super clear around what's the difference we want to make in the world and why would the world rather than us find that to be of value. So, you know, really getting away from the, if you like, the provider side view of value into, you know, what's the world going to get from us that it's prepared to pay for or that it sees as worthwhile. And so if we start there, the next step is to then think about, so if that's what we're here to achieve, what are the things we would need to be great at in order to achieve that? So I call those the core capabilities. That's thinking about what are the few things that, as an organization, we need to be amazing at that would mean we can achieve our purpose. As we identify those core capabilities, we're then able to start to describe for each of them what would good look like. So what would being great at those things look like in practice? And that becomes our first set of confirmation statements. So I would start there But I think building out from there, I talk about the five conversations that make work work. Essentially, my experience is you need confirmation practices in five areas because that helps you to talk about the right things in the right way while staying focused on what matters. So one of those is what I call process confirmation, essentially the process by which we meet our purpose. So that's, in traditional terms, that's the conversation about our performance. I also talk about progress confirmation. So this is, given that we have agreed some things we need to focus on for improvement, how are we doing at making progress against those things? So that's essentially just checking in on, are we honouring the commitments we made to each other? There's then personal confirmation, which is checking in with each other that, you know, we're each doing okay. And also in the way that you described, it's the kind of buddying bit, the supported self-reflection around, am I doing the things that mean I'm making the contribution I want to make? So that's three conversations. A fourth conversation is the checkout practices that I described earlier. And the fifth conversation is the second order confirmation practices, the checking that we're doing the other four things well. And my experience is whether you're a startup or whether you're an established organization, if those five conversations aren't happening regularly and in a way that's generative and healthy rather than in a way that's pathological, then you've got a problem. So for established businesses, I would start with how are the five conversations that matter going? And with a startup business, I'd go purpose, core capabilities, and then the five conversations that matter.
Thank you. That is really clear. My experience has been doing them around my role in the way that we've described. And next week, the national team are using confirmation practices to review how we're doing in our team agreements. And as you've just captured there, that's how are we doing in the way that we work together. But I found them so useful, Andy, for just having them at the end of my desk as a way of keeping track on, am I keeping on top of the things that really matter. So they've been so powerful for me personally, us in the national team, and for wellbeing teams generally. And if somebody was listening to this and thought, well, how do I as a team leader get started with this? What would you recommend?
So there are a few things for people to do. The first one is if they go to my website, there's a range of blogs, some of them you and I co-authored together, that walk people through sort of the basics of confirmation practices. And I think for a lot of people, that might be enough that they could get started on that basis. Also in the process of putting together some regular webinars, so if people keep their eyes peeled on my website, they'll see those and they'll be free to attend. If they wanted to get in touch with me as well, I've got a little resource pack, which again is free, and it kind of collates some of the blogs that I've mentioned alongside other resources. And I guess finally, the other thing they can do, they can drop me a line and we can have a chat. So I'm always super happy to provide a bit of light touch support in that regard. And depending on the size of the organization and kind of what they need, of course, I provide a service around helping people to do this. So there's quite a few options for them.
Thank you. And the best email address for you, Andy?
andy@easierinc.com.
When I was explaining about confirmation practices to a group of care home managers, one of the managers said, could I swap what I'm currently doing around supervision for confirmation practices so that somebody would come to supervision and we'd have agreed their statements together and we'd have a conversation about what score they'd give themselves, why, and what they were going to do to improve? What would you say to moving forward in that kind of way?
Yes, they absolutely can do that. However, it has to change what supervision is about and what it means. So that can happen in a way that would still leave you compliant with CQC and other inspection regimes. But the key thing that needs to be recognised is that the individual won't be scoring themselves as such. Rather, they'll be scoring how they feel about things that matter in their work. So it's kind of moving away from scoring the person to helping the person to reflect on how are things going and what's the opportunity to maximise their contribution. Now that might feel subtle, but I think it's really important because it's essentially ensuring that supervision stays out of the realm of someone being evaluated and stays in the realm of someone being supported to reflect accurately.
So if it's seen as an opportunity to reflect together, then that is completely different to supervision being a conversation about how well you're doing.
Exactly.
Please come back again and have another conversation, Andy, because I know there'll be lots of tips for how to do this well and learning about things to avoid. And perhaps we could do a follow-up podcast in a few months around that.
That sounds fantastic. I'll give that 5 out of 5 in confirmation statement terms. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Brilliant. Thanks, Helen.
Thank you for listening. I'd love to hear your reflections. Please tweet me. I'm at Helen@WBTeams. This podcast is a companion to Open Teams. On this podcast, we share the voices and stories of pioneering organizations in health, care, and public services. And on Open Teams, you can see the documents that they're using. Have a look at openteams.co.uk. And if you're interested in wellbeing teams, please come and find me on LinkedIn, where I share a weekly 2-minute film, or my blog site, helensanderson.net. And finally, if you're interested in self-management and need some support along the way, I'd love to hear from you. I'm at helen@wellbeingteams.org. Thank you.